uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Happy Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, TomHartman.com. The website. Welcome back to our program. Today, it's the first hour of the last day of the week, our program. Traditionally, when we have Congressman Bernie Sanders on, Bernie will be with us in just a few minutes. He had to run down to the floor of the House and take a vote. And as soon as he gets back, Louise will let me know, and we will drop him onto the air here. But for the moment, we are waiting. In the meantime, we have Rovegate, some people are calling it. I prefer to call it Treasongate. The question in my mind, and I just got this, it's published on commondreams.org right now if you want to read the op-ed. But it gets back to this piece in the Wall Street Journal today. And this, what I found particularly fascinating about this is that folks from the Wall Street Journal, a reporter from the Wall Street Journal was on MSNBC last night on a couple of the news shows saying, you know, tomorrow we're going to reveal that in the Wall Street Journal that the memo, the original memo, that disclosed that Joe Wilson's wife worked for the CIA was not only classified top secret, but that the paragraph referring to Valerie Plame in it, Valerie Plame Wilson, that paragraph was marked S/NF, which means share not foreign. In other words, do not share this information with foreign intelligence services. We routinely share top secret information with other spies from other countries. It's not an uncommon thing. So just because something's marked not top secret doesn't mean that the head of the CIA can't discuss it with the head of MI5. But this was so secret that it said that the head of the CIA should not even discuss it with the head of British MI5 or any other friendly intelligence agency. That it simply should not be done. And that document then found its way from Air Force One into the hands of Robert Novak. How did that happen? Well, we're still trying to figure it out, and time will tell as this story plays out. Congressman Bernie Sanders is with us now. Hey, Bernie. Oh, sorry about that. Got to push the right button. There you go.
Tom, how are you?
I am great. How are you today, Bernie?
I'm very well, thanks.
Great to have you back with us. You were running down to the House floor to vote?
Yes.
What was up?
That was the NASA bill, and I was one of the relatively few to vote against it. Not because I have any particular dislike for NASA, but if we can't take care of people who have no health care and can't fund kids' ability to go to college and we can't deal with homelessness and with our veterans, I think maybe we shouldn't be spending quite so much money on NASA. So.
Bernie, you're being consistent.
I mean,
that's logical. That's not supposed to happen in politics.
Well, it didn't happen terribly much today. I think the NASA appropriation won overwhelmingly. But
sure.
But there is an issue I wanted to get into a little bit, Tom, is I think probably a lot of the listeners are familiar with the fact that yesterday the House dealt with the USA Patriot Act, and the Senate is also dealing with it, both in the Judiciary Committee and in the Intelligence Committee. So there's some interesting developments taking place. From my perspective, the bad news is that it passed in the House, and it was not a very good bill at all. The good news is that whereas when it originally passed in 2001, I think we had 66 people voting against it. Yesterday, I don't have the vote in front of me, but I think we had substantially more than that. It was a pretty decent vote against it. And in the Senate, at least on the Judiciary Committee, they are coming up with some language, which is far better than we have seen in the past. And as I've said many times, Tom, and certainly as London indicated a couple of weeks ago and even just yesterday, terrorism is a really, really serious business, and we can't ignore that for one moment. But the great challenge that we as a nation, as a free society, have is how you deal with terrorism without undermining the freedoms that our Constitution has enshrined. And I fear very much that there are a whole lot of folks out there who say, oh, got to do anything we can to fight terrorism. It doesn't matter if we take away basic liberties that the American people have enjoyed for a few centuries.
So how do we fight terrorism without giving up our civil liberties?
You have good, effective, well-trained law enforcement agencies, and many of them are, in fact, just that. You make sure that they are vigorous in fighting terrorism. I think every listener wants to know, I want to know, that if the FBI or another government agency believes that somebody is a terrorist, we're going to investigate that person, we're going to arrest that person, we're going to put them away forever. I mean, I'm not, that's what we've got to do. On the other hand, what you cannot do, I think, is simply give a blank check to law enforcement agencies and have them harassing or investigating innocent Americans. That's not what our country is about. Now, the issue that I have been involved in deals with Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, which has allowed government agents to go into libraries and bookstores without really making the case that the person that they might be looking at is involved in terrorism. And that has concerned me, it's concerned librarians, it's concerned bookstore owners, it's concerned millions of Americans who don't want to believe that the books that they're taking out may end up on some FBI list. The good news there is last month we passed an amendment with strong bipartisan support to take libraries and bookstores out of Section 215. That was the good news. The bad news is that the Judiciary Committee refused to put that language in the bill, and outrageously, and through an outrageous abuse of power, in my view, the leadership refused to allow that amendment, that same amendment, to come down to the floor of the House yesterday during the Patriot Act discussion, precisely as everybody knows, because they knew it would pass. So we have language which has passed the House with strong bipartisan support, and the leadership said, so what? We don't care what the will of the majority of the members of the House. We're not going to allow that to be voted on. That's the bad news. Then the good news, again, is that the Judiciary Committee has put some language in which essentially says that the FBI cannot get information unless they have reason to believe there's some grounds to think that somebody is involved in terrorism. So that's a step forward.
Speaking of a reason to believe, Bernie, in New York City now, Mayor Bloomberg has said that they're going to randomly search people's backpacks on the subway system. It's interesting to see the cleavage on this. Yesterday, somebody called me about it, and I said, well, you know, if we consent to being searched before we get on an airplane, which is public transportation, getting on a subway is really no different, and there should be a consent to be searched. Or we should, as a society, examine the whole thing and say, we're not going to search anybody anytime, or, you know, we do it with public transportation. On the other hand, there's a lot of progressives who, there's a good piece on Common Dreams today, saying, refuse to be searched in New York City. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a tough one, Tom. You're going to have to go it. You have to play it. Case by case. I believe I do a lot of traveling. In a few hours, I'm going to be on an airplane.
Me too.
When I feel comfortable that nobody there went through metal detectors and was searched, no, I wouldn't. Do I believe that there are people out there who would blow up airplanes? The answer is obviously I do. So I think, you know, it's not my view that there is not a problem. We don't have to worry about it. I think that would be absurd. On the other hand, I think we need restraint and we need to look at these things on a case by case basis. So in terms of the Patriot Bill, what we're seeing now is, and people should be aware of this, the House passed its version yesterday. And another serious concern is that the reason we addressed the bill this year is there are a number of sunset provisions, which means that everything being equal, a provision expires unless it's not reauthorized. The advantage of that is it mandates that Congress will take a look at a provision, see how well it's working. Is it working well? Is it not? Where does it need improvement? Should it be junked completely? Is the, you know, Justice Department overstepping its bounds, et cetera, et cetera? One of the very negative things that was passed yesterday is that all of the sunsets, 14 out of the 16 sunsets, were removed and two were given 10-year sunsets, which is, to my mind, absurd. So we hope to see the Senate doing a lot better than that and keep this issue on the spotlight, make sure it comes back to Congress for periodical reviews.
Okay. Bernie, Judge Roberts has been put forward. What are your thoughts on Judge Roberts?
Well, not much. I don't know any more about Judge Roberts than most people know. I think from the president's point of view, it was probably a smart appointment for just that reason. He has a very slim paper trail. We don't know a whole lot about him. He's certainly not some kind of, right-wing nut who has, you know, graduated from some dinky law school and has been spending his life in right-wing extremist activity. That's not who he is. He graduated Harvard Law School. He's articulate. He's smart. He's argued before the Supreme Court in many cases. So I think from Bush's perspective, he has brought forth somebody who at first blush is reasonable. And it really is going to be the function of the confirmation process in the Senate to ask very, very probing questions about his judicial philosophy. But I think anyone who can make, you know, very broad statements about them now is maybe speaking a little bit off the top of their heads, because we just don't know about them, enough about them.
Bernie, we read in the paper yesterday or the day before, I forget which, that the morale among troops is improving. It turns out, however, that this study was the previous last year's statistics were done on troops returning who were going through the VA hospital system and whatnot, and they found, you know, fairly high levels of depression and PTSD and that kind of thing. This year's study was done where they actually went to the troops in the field in Iraq, where people would be much more reluctant to say, yes, I have psychological problems, something like that. So I think that this is really speaking. In the meantime, the Bush administration has been flip-flopping back and forth and back and forth about whether they're going to fund veterans, whether they're not.
Right.
What's going on with this?
Well, that's a huge issue. Tom, that is an issue that concerns me very, very much. I voted against giving the president authority to go to war. I believe the time is long overdue for the president to give us an exit strategy as to when our troops are going to start coming home. And I want to mention something in a minute about an interesting amendment that was on the floor of the House yesterday. But in terms, what really upsets me, and it should upset every American, regardless of his or her position on this war, is the terrible way that this Bush administration has treated our veterans. Right now, in VA hospitals and clinics all over this country, there are waiting lines for veterans who have served this country to get the care that they need. There are very long time periods before people can get the benefits that they're entitled to. And everybody knew that the VA was grossly underfunded. And ironically here, a fellow from New Jersey, a very conservative Republican named Chris Smith. Chris was the chairman of the House Veterans Committee. And Chris got up and he said, Veterans Administration is grossly underfunded. And do you know what the Republican leadership did to him?
They got rid of him.
They got rid of him.
Yeah.
This guy is a conservative Republican, but he actually thought that his job as chairman of the Veterans Committee was to stand up for veterans, and that was unacceptable to the Republican leadership.
Now, we got
to
have money for the tax cuts for billionaires.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
Meanwhile, priorities.
Meanwhile, the Bush administration and the VA, there's no problem. And then just a few weeks ago, it comes out that there's a huge shortfall this year. And what I worry about very, very much is what is going to be available for the young men and women who are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Because if we do not substantially increase funding, these folks are going to have a very, very hard time getting the care that they need. Because one of the things, apparently, as I understand it, I'm not an expert on this, is that a lot of these guys are coming back not only with serious injuries, but with some a lot of stress syndrome as well.
A lot of trauma. And it's going to take years to treat, years to deal with, and we don't want another generation of homeless vets because of mental illness from the battlefield that was never treated appropriately. Terrible problem. Congressman Bernie Sanders, our phone number, 866-889-8894. Bernie, we'll take your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Recall when I said I'd leave no child behind. I guess I changed my mind.
Yeah, Bush does that sometimes.
Luckily, I bribed you with my tax cut con. The rich got richer, soon the surplus was gone. Prosperity replaced by unemployment and debt. Who could ask for more? It may take amnesia for me to still please you in 2004.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. It's the Brunch with Bernie segment of our program. Congressman Bernie Sanders, his website, bernie.house.gov or www.bernie.org. Our telephone number, if you'd like to talk with Congressman Sanders, 1-866-889-8894. Toll free across the United States, 866-889-8894. And if you're calling from outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Bernie, Harold in Vermont is on the line. Hey, Harold, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Bernie.
Yes.
I've been researching biofuels, and I've come up with what I believe to be a simple and efficient way to produce biofuels, which could have a huge impact on our energy problem.
Geez, Harold, you want to put the oil companies out of business?
Uh-oh.
Well, no. No, I don't want to butt heads with them. It's just some simple ideas.
Okay.
If I could have 2 quick minutes, it won't even take two, but 2 quick minutes to explain how it's done.
Well, why don't you be brief here, Harold, and if you want to call our office up in Vermont, you can do that.
It won't take long at all.
Okay.
This is it. Today, a farmer grows corn to feed his cattle. At the end of the season, he chops it up and puts it in a silo. My idea is before he does that, he takes the corn, after he chops it up, he puts it in a press. He squeezes it. Now you have corn oil or biodiesel. Then after that process, he puts it into a solar distiller.
Uh-huh.
You get the energy from the sun to heat the corn and extract the ethanol from the corn. Now,
you'd have to ferment it first, Harold.
Right, yes, but you use solar energy for your energy source. And then that extracting the alcohol does not affect the nutritional value of the corn whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Now you've extracted the oil you can use as biodiesel. You've extracted the alcohol, which you can use as ethanol, and then you can still feed it back to your cows and produce milk and meat, and that's it.
Oh, that sounds actually like an interesting idea.
Well, great. I'm glad you like it, Bernie. Well, maybe you can talk to some people that are producing biodiesel.
And it might be a source of additional revenue for farmers as well.
Yes. It's a win-win. And if you wanted to, if the breadbasket of the world, America, right, was to stop paying subsidies to farmers to not grow crops,
right,
and tell them grow as much as you like, and then we take the byproducts after the process and we could ship that stuff around the world and feed everybody.
Or we could
just a couple simple ideas. Hey,
well,
have a good day, gentlemen.
Thank you, Harold. Good to hear from you.
Well, we could just
produce our own fuel.
I mean, Harold raises a question I think everybody understands, and Harold's idea is interesting, is there is huge potential out there for sustainable energy. And one of the real crimes of what's going on in our country today is the degree to which the oil companies, the nuclear power companies, all these guys have so much power. We continue doing it the same old way. We drive automobiles, which get worse mileage per gallon. We're moving in the wrong direction when the technology is there to get 50, 60, 80 miles per gallon.
Is anything being done about this in Congress, Bernie?
No. Well, the House bill, of course, was a total disaster. The Senate bill is a little bit better. I mean, yes, some things are. There's credits going out for wind energy and there's some money going into solar and so forth.
But by and large, with Republicans in charge, it's all money going to the oil industry, right?
Right. I mean, and what we all know is, for example, in terms of solar panels, if we started producing these things big time, if we made real contracts with the companies that produce these things, you could substantially lower the price. And just move forward to alternative energies so quickly.
Then you get huge economies of scale. Lines are open if you'd like to call in. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. What would you like to discuss with a member of Congress? Congressman Bernie Sanders, America's congressman, the only independent member of the entire House of Representatives, the longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. I'm Tom Hartman, 29 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Don't stand by while democracy dies. Don't stand by, don't swallow their lies. Don't stand by till we lose the prize. You've got to open your eyes.
There you go, and get active. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. This hour, the Brunch with Bernie segment. Once a week, we have Congressman Bernie Sanders on, America's congressman, in my opinion, the only independent member, not a Democrat, not a Republican, the only independent member of the entire House of Representatives, the longest-serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. And we got a bunch of calls here, Bernie. Tom in South Carolina, you're up first. Hey, Tom, you're live and on the air with Congressman Sanders. Turn down your radio, please.
Okay. How are you?
That's fine. You're live and on the air, Tom. What's up?
Oh, excellent. I just wanted to expand upon the idea of the energy thing. You know, there's enough solar energy falling on the roofs of our houses to supply most of our domestic needs. And, you know, I think that the money that we're getting ready to spend in Alaska just to find oil for about 1 year, we could build solar panel factories to, you know, to supply the needs.
That's
for,
right.
You know,
now, Tom, you got it exactly right. Just think that if we made a fraction of the effort for solar energy that we make for nuclear power, think of what we could produce. And
it's
tremendous. Yeah, and as you know, Tom Hartman mentioned a moment ago, the magnitude of, when we put so much money into it, the scale, the magnitude of the scale of it will drive prices down big time.
Right.
Yeah. Tom, thanks for the call and good point you make. Kirk in Rochester, New York on the line. Hey, Kirk, welcome. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Thanks, Tom. The reason that I'm calling is I own a small alternative energy company in Rochester, New York.
And good on you.
It's fantastic. Things are doing so well. The only problem is we cannot get enough panels to satisfy the demand. If I had 10,000 panels today, I could sell them by tomorrow.
That is incredible.
We're just not producing
enough in the country, or
we're not producing any. We're even looking at China, India, any place that we can get a panel, we'll buy it from. But we can't even get them because there's such a glut on them. And when you take a look at the industry, some of your biggest companies that produce them, Shell, BP, these are the oil companies. They're limiting the amount that can be produced.
BP is actually the largest producer of solar panels in the world right now, I believe.
So BP?
Yeah.
Kirk, are you finding other people in the business experiencing the same problem that you are?
This industry is in turmoil because we cannot get panels. There are large distributors. Actually, what they're doing is they're siphoning many of those panels to Europe, Germany, Luxembourg, because they have such great programs over there where the governments are financing it. It's actually driving people out of business here in the U.S. because we can't get them.
Okay. I'm going to look in that, Kirk. I am going to take a look at that. I will want to, so that you understand how absurd what our government is doing right now, we have been fighting against a $5 billion loan from the Export-Import Bank of the United States government to build nuclear power plants in China.
In China?
In China.
In communist dictatorship,
yeah.
China.
With a company that has been involved in providing nuclear secrets to Pakistan and, I believe, Iran. But the point here is, think of what a $5 billion loan might do to companies in the United States of America who are producing solar panels. Makes a little bit more sense to me.
Yeah, I have a feeling Kirk in New York there, if we just gave him $5 million, he could do very well, much less $5 billion. Okay, Mike in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi. I have a general comment about energy in that the first step we have to do is conservation. We have to.
Right.
There's no way the alternatives can supply what we're using right now. And about the gentleman who first spoke, he has the main problem of getting something for nothing. When you press out the oil, some of the calories go.
Right.
When you press out when you do the fermentation, some of the calories go.
Yeah, that's true. But biodiesel is an alternative. I think can play a very important role in filling some energy needs, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so, too. I'm sorry, he's gone.
Yeah.
In fact, we've got a biodiesel plant here that just opened in Oregon, and they're just doing great guns. Here in Portland, people are modifying their cars, and this is happening all over the country. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeff in Boulder, Colorado. Jeff, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Bernie, you're the highlight of my week. Just to discuss the previous subject, printable semiconductors may solve that problem in another couple of years. It could be that people can just make their own solar panels in another 5 years with nothing more than an inkjet printer.
Wow.
But that's not what I wanted to ask about.
Okay.
I'm an engineer, and I'm seeing my profession being eviscerated right now. My program manager just got back from D.C. about 3 weeks ago. They had some aerospace summit, technology summit thing in which he met with a bunch of the senators there. And they were talking about how the solution to the problem was that we didn't have enough engineers in the country, and we had to release the restriction on the H-1 visas, and that we needed to have foreign engineers coming into America in order to solve the outsourcing problem. The logic on it was very twisted, and it made me think that the people in our Senate are just completely clueless as to what's actually happening in the country.
Well, Jeff, I would agree with most of what you said, except I would not use the word clueless. This is part of an overall trade and economic approach, which I think has been a disaster for the middle class. But the first point that you made, just stop and think. Everybody in this country talks about the need for decent-paying jobs. Well, when you're an engineer, it's a decent-paying job. Who believes that we cannot educate the young people in this country to do a good job as engineers? I mean, it is astronomically dumb. It's really crazy to think that we can't do that. And the idea that we have to bring in people from abroad to fill those needs is pretty pathetic. But the reason, Jeff, which I think you should think about a little bit, is people who are going to come from Eastern Europe, from the former Soviet Union, and so forth, are going to be working for a lot lower wages than American engineers are accustomed to working for. So I see this as one part of the effort to lower wages in America, move us downwards rather than upwards. And corporations, of course, would prefer to pay somebody from Russia a lower wage than somebody from the United States a higher wage.
The net result, though, is that it's actually taking incentives away from actually having the country stay a high-tech leader in the world.
Absolutely.
I met a kid a couple of weeks ago who said, why in the world would I ever go to college? He says, all of my friends who are going to college come out, they have big student loans to pay off, and they're getting low-paying jobs. And he had an example. He said a friend of his just graduated who was a pharmacist and was making $10 an hour. And he says, I make twice that much, and I just graduated from high school and went straight to work.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right, Jeff. So this is a serious problem, but it's part of corporate America's war against the middle class. And what they're saying is, why would we want to pay well-educated Americans good wages, good salaries, good benefits as engineers when we can import lower-wage labor from former Soviet Union and so forth?
Yeah.
And it's a terrible thing. It is something that we are watching, but don't be naive about it. This is something that corporate America likes.
And it wasn't always this way, Bernie. By the way, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. 15, 20 years ago, I ran an ad agency in Atlanta, and we had a client who we did a publication for, a multinational corporation, and they wanted a newsletter that was done in Japanese, Spanish, and English. And I had to look for somebody who could write and proofread in all three languages who had a graphic arts degree. And it turns out that there was this guy. We found him. His name was Shinji. I'm not going to give his last name on the air. He was ethnically Japanese. He was born in Peru. His parents were Japanese immigrants to Peru. In Peru, he learned Spanish and Japanese. He moved to the United States with his family when he was 13 years old, learned English, fluent in three languages, and had a bachelor's degree in fine arts in graphic design. But he had a visa. He wasn't a U.S. citizen. He was a Peruvian citizen. And I had to go through 3 months of jumping through all kinds of hoops with the Immigration and Naturalization Service to get this guy a visa so that I could employ him. And now, apparently, all you have to do is say, hey, I'm a Republican. I want cheap labor. And this wasn't about cheap. This was about a specific skill set. It used to be you could only get a foreign visa holder if you could prove that no American could do the job. And I couldn't find an American who had all three skills.
But there's no question. I think Jeff's point is this H-1B approach, visa approach, is being unfairly used. And the message and the signal that goes out to young Americans is just as Jeff said. Why should I go to college? Why should I go to graduate degree? Why should I spend all of that money if somebody else is going to get the job at lower wages from abroad? It's a very bad message to send out to the younger generation.
Yeah, and then we had the Wall Street Journal just 4 days ago, 3 days ago, running a major editorial on their editorial page calling for the 10 million illegal immigrants in the United States to simply immediately overnight be made citizens so that they can join the workforce and help save American industry.
That's right. I mean, that's part of the same process. It's another aspect of the trade policy. But the bottom line is forcing American workers to compete against people who in every instance can work for far, far lower wages. Sometimes it's H-1B people come into this country. More often, it's jobs going to China and other low-wage countries.
Right. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Becca in Vermont is on the line. Hey, Becca, welcome to the program. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say it's I'm very excited to be from Bernie's home state of Vermont. My question has to do with myself being a member of the Vermont Army National Guard and having sent the 1,200 soldiers overseas. How can we get them back home, and is that going to happen anytime soon?
Well, Becca, that is a very good question. And the answer is that there is a huge debate now taking place here in Washington. I am concerned that after the loss of so many lives, after so many young people, including many from the state of Vermont, having been injured and dead, that the president still has not come up with an exit strategy. And we're putting the pressure on the president to do just that. And what I will tell you is more and more members of Congress, not just Democrats, but Republicans as well, are saying, wait a minute, enough is enough. The time has got to be coming when the Iraqi government can defend itself, can take care of itself. We should support them. But we should be working on an exit strategy, and we should begin the process of bringing our troops home. I know a lot of the people in the National Guard are upset about how long they have had to serve. And we owe it to them, and we owe it to the taxpayers of this country to start bringing our troops back home. How do you feel about that, Becca?
I agree. I think that we as the National Guard have no place being overseas. I think that not being a soldier every day, like active duty Army, puts us in a difficult spot. Mm-hmm. I would not feel comfortable with the training I've received, you know, being in my civilian job, having to up and go overseas and defend the country.
Well, Becca, I want to tell you something, because I've gone to a lot of deployments from the state of Vermont, and I'm always impressed by the courage of the people who are going and their understanding that they signed up with the possibility that it could happen, and they do it without complaints. But on the other hand, it is astounding to me to see people who are 40, who are 50, who are working in offices or auto repair shops, who never in a million years thought that they would be in the middle of a hot war.
Yeah. Becca, thanks a lot for the call and for calling in from Vermont. Much appreciated. Got a lot of calls here. Bernie, Herman in Palm Springs, Mike in Salisbury, Maryland, Evan in Michigan, Bill in Tifton, Vin in...
And you were worried we weren't going to get enough calls, right?
No, I'm never worried about that. It never happens. Herman in Palm Springs, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Good morning. How you guys doing?
Great. Good. What's up?
Well, one of the things that bothers me about this business with China is no one's talking about how China is buying up all our debt. I don't see how you can really talk about whether it's them buying an oil company or threatening to nuke us if we get involved with Taiwan when we don't talk about the underlying fact that they're financing a lot of our debt that goes towards paying for things like the Iraq war.
Well, I think Herman makes a very important point. It is about some of us are talking about it. And some of us are raising a lot of concerns about our relationship to China. Let me be very frank in saying I want to see us have a positive relationship with China. I don't want another Cold War. But on the other hand, what we know is we have a $160 billion trade deficit. We've lost millions of good-paying jobs. Many large corporations basically are heading to China as quickly as they can and throwing American workers out on the street. And Herman raises another aspect of that problem with this huge trade deficit. China is now buying up a whole lot of our debt. And the concern there is they now have a whole lot of political leverage over the United States in terms of policy issues, because they are prepared to say, okay, hey, you want to do this, we're going to start selling that debt. And that'll have a significant impact on our financial structure. So
devastate our economy.
Yeah, well, yeah. Herman makes a good point.
Yeah.
But it's the time is long overdue. And I'm happy to say that I'm beginning to see some things happening. And maybe, as Herman also indicated, when you have a high-ranking Chinese general suggesting that they may wage a preemptive nuclear war against the United States, maybe a few people's eyes opened up a little bit. So we want a good relationship with China, but a lot of bad things are happening that we have got to begin addressing.
Well said. Mike in Salisbury, Maryland. We have about a minute and a half left. Hey, Mike.
How you doing there? Thanks for taking my call. I just had an observation in the discussion we've been having here that on your show and many other shows, we refer to corporate America as some sort of monolithic evil. The corporate America is made up of people. These are companies that produce products and their responsibility to try to stay in business. And, you know, I guess maybe if our government legislated certain isolationistic policies and such, that may be an answer. But multinationals in Europe certainly look for cheap labor as well. I don't think that.
But they have a different set of rules, and they're restricted. Okay.
Well, they may have a different set of rules, but I mean, gosh, there's Dutch-based companies that have lots of cheap labor that they import from elsewhere as well. And I don't think it's necessarily right for the American worker, but it's the only way that they can make a bottom line.
Well, Mike, let me just respond to you in this way. And you're absolutely right. There are, you know, zillions of different corporations with different philosophies. I have to tell you that as a member of Congress, whose job it is, constitutional responsibility is to protect the American people, I have a lot of concerns about what corporate America is doing against the needs of the middle class. We can talk about that in a moment.
Okay, we'll come back from this break and give you an opportunity, Bernie, to finish your response to that and get on with our other calls. It's 10 minutes before the hour. It's Tom Hartman with you, Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. We'll be right back.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number, Yvonne in Michigan. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
Thank you for your show. And, Bernie, I appreciate and respect your service to this country.
Thank you.
Too bad there aren't a lot more like you.
Thank you very much.
And my question is, I would like to know if you know who that one person is that always votes with the Republicans, and sometimes there are as many as 30 that always vote with the Republicans. Who that one person is?
I don't know that it's just one person. There are a number of Democrats who will vote with the Republicans more often than they'll vote with the Democrats. These are conservative Democrats. And,
do you know what part of the country they're from? Are they
often from, you know, some of them are from the South. Some of them are...
Oh, okay. And I just want to let you know I'm having a party tomorrow, a DSM party, Conyers DSM party.
For the John Conyers thing.
Yes.
That's great.
And I've got a lot of excited people coming.
That's
so
great. That's
we're
great,
working Yvonne. At the grassroots level.
Well, okay. John does a very good job on issues.
Yeah, he does. Thanks, Yvonne. Vin in Santa Fe, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Vin, what's up?
Hi, gentlemen. You were talking about education of engineers, and, you know, engineers have to be critical thinkers. And I don't see that coming out of No Child Left Behind. I see a lot of simplistic behavior toward No Child Left Behind. You hear commercials by teachers in New York saying, well, we need funding. I think we need to get rid of No Child Left Behind because I don't think it encourages critical thinking. I think it's basically a rote kind of teach to the test kind of thing, and I'd like to know what Bernie thinks about it.
I agree with you. I think you said it very well. It teaches people how to take tests rather than how to be creative. It stymies the flexibility and the creativity of our teachers. I don't think it's a good idea.
Will in Pittsburgh. We have a half a minute left. Hey, Will.
Thanks for taking my call, gentlemen. I guess I got to rush now. I've decided to go solar. It was disheartening to hear from that gentleman in Buffalo that it's so difficult. Congressman, our education system is in shambles due to the powerful government teachers' unions.
Will, I'm sorry. We're out of time. And I got to say, I don't think it's due to our unions. Bernie?
I don't think it's due to our unions either, and we'll call back next week and we can continue that discussion.
Yeah, in fact, our unions have been the strongest advocates for our educational system, the teachers' unions in particular. Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment, thanks so much for being with us, Bernie.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And,
bye-bye.
And Will, give us a call next week. We'll talk about that topic some more. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into the live chat room and participate. You're in the real free speech zone. No RNC pass required.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. What happened? What really happened on 9/11? Nafees Ahmed is the executive director of the Institute for Policy Research and Development in England. He's a regular political commentary on BBC Radio, the author of War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked, September 11, 2001, which won him the Naples Prize, Italy's most prestigious literary award, and has now come out with a follow-up book, a sequel, The War on Truth, 9/11 Disinformation, and the Anatomy of Terrorism. Now, Nafees Ahmed, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us, what don't we know about 9/11? What is wrong with the government's analysis of 9/11?
It's a big question. Almost everything, unfortunately. In my book, I try to look at the historical context as well as what we're doing today in the world in relation to Al-Qaeda. And I tie that in with an analysis of exactly what happened on 9/11 in terms of the intelligence failure and the air defense failure. But I guess my overall argument, my overall thesis is that we have been consistently connecting ourselves with Al-Qaeda, not only prior to 9/11, but even today.
Connecting ourselves with? What do you mean by that?
Connecting ourselves in a variety of interesting ways. I mean, the conventional wisdom tells us that, you know, we only connected ourselves with Al-Qaeda during the Cold War. You know, we had Osama bin Laden working with us through the Saudis, through the Pakistanis, to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan. And after that, we didn't have anything to do with these Mujahideen. But this is actually incorrect. In many ways, in the post-Cold War period, we have allied ourselves with states that are supporting Al-Qaeda. We have, in fact, directly got ourselves involved with Al-Qaeda. And I'll give you some examples to substantiate this. And one of the most prominent examples straight after the Cold War is what happened in the Balkans, in the Bosnian War, and subsequently later on in the war in Kosovo. We actually flew in the first Bosnian War in 1992 to 1995. The Pentagon organized an air funnel of Mujahideen to go into the Bosnian conflict. There are a number of reports to this effect. Yusuf Badansky, who is the director of the Congressional Task Force on Terrorism, has confirmed that we flew these Mujahideen in up to 1,000 or so. And we used them, we liaised with them. Special forces were seen mingling with them to essentially manipulate the Bosnian conflict.
Now, Fiz Ahmed, if we were working with the Mujahideen, with the precursor to Al-Qaeda, why did they attack us on 9/11?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because Al-Qaeda ultimately is a vehemently anti-American, anti-Western organization. But it seems to me that there was a decision made at some point, I think, during the Cold War, the strategic decision made that, well, you know, Al-Qaeda, there is a danger here, but we can use this to our interests. There was a statement made by a CIA analyst, which I obtained, and he said that, this was in about 1990 or something. He said that, well, you know, we thought we could use Islam not just in Afghanistan, but also beyond Afghanistan to destabilize Russian power and Chinese power. So it's pretty clear that there was this thinking going on in certain circles. And what we seem to have done, we seem to have thought that, well, you know, if we selectively use Al-Qaeda, then we won't really have to worry too much. But we've systematically done this. We did this not only in Bosnia, then subsequently later on in Kosovo. Again, you know, the KLA has been well known.
Right, but and what we discovered is that if you lay down with dogs, you get fleas.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left with this, and I'd like to get to the kernels of this stuff.
Yeah.
9/11, you said we had intelligence failures, air defense failures. Why?
Yeah, okay, intelligence failures. We had an abundance of information prior to 9/11 that seemed to indicate that fairly precise, advanced warning of exactly what was going to happen. I mean, we had information about airplanes being hijacked and used as weapons to target key symbols in the United States, key symbolic structures.
George Bush had this information.
Yes. I mean, it was known as Project Boyinka since 1995.
Project what?
Boyinka.
How do you spell it?
You spell that B-O-J-I-N-K, but the J is silent. This was a plot hatched in the Philippines by a guy, Abdul Hakim Murad, and some other people. And these guys were actually linked up to the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And they hatched this grand plan to blow up. It had two dimensions. One, they wanted to blow up 11 airliners over the Pacific, and another one to hijack planes within the United States and hurl them into a number of buildings. And the buildings they listed included the World Trade Center, the Sears Tower in Chicago, the Pentagon and the CIA headquarters, and the White House, and I think several other buildings. And this information, I mean, what the conventional wisdom tells them, I mean, the 9/11 Commission, for example, has said that this information wasn't circulated sufficiently within the intelligence community. But I found reports in the public record from, you know, credible newspapers and so on and so forth, which show that the FBI received this information from their counterparts in the Philippines and acted on it, and they looked at flight schools in the United States. There's one article in the Washington Post which said that the FBI has known for years that terrorists have been training at flight schools.
Well, we had Colleen Rowley, who found this guy up in Minneapolis. I mean, or in Minnesota. Was the federal government impeding these things out of incompetence or out of complicity?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, if you look at the Colleen Rowley memo, I mean, what happened with Colleen Rowley? The Massawi case. Basically, the information on Massawi was made available to this unit, this supervisory unit in the FBI, Radical Fundamentalist Unit. The same guy, David Frasca, who obtained this information, that Massawi, this guy, he's a terrorist, he's suspected terrorist, he's in the United States, and he's training at flight schools. This guy also received another memo, the Phoenix memo, and this memo basically contained information showing that generally there is a danger, there's an influx of Al-Qaeda operatives into the country, and these people want to carry out an attack. And flight schools is where they're looking. So the Massawi memo was Massawi information, essentially a confirmation of
so,
what the Phoenix
so what did this guy
us.
What did this guy do with it?
This guy, he basically took this information and he sat on it.
Why?
We have no idea. We know for a fact. We have good reason to believe that the information that he received was passed on to the CIA director George Tenet, because George Tenet made some statements subsequently. I can't remember. It was quoted in a newspaper in the USA that, well, you know, we know that there's a terrorist attack being planned, and I think this guy might have something to do with it. He was clearly referring to Massawi, and we know for a fact was regularly briefing President George W. Bush in the months and weeks prior to 9/11.
So Tenet and Bush knew that this was coming and didn't do anything about it. Is that what you're saying?
They had information that this guy was an Al-Qaeda terrorist, that they were planning to do attacks in the United States. They were planning to hijack aircraft. And most disturbingly, in the week before 9/11, an FBI operative agent, he raised a question to the supervisors. He said, I think that this guy is going to, he wanted to fly a plane into the World Trade Center. And that information was circulated in the upper echelons of the FBI. Very precise information, yeah, and yet nothing was done.
So why was nothing done? Was it that George W. Bush and Tenet wanted their Pearl Harbor moment so that they could reshape the world? Or was it that they were just, you know, I mean, George Bush, my recollection is he got over 56 memos specifically talking about these kinds of things.
Yeah.
The last one was on August 6th that said Bin Laden determined strike inside the United States. What does
yeah.
he do? He goes on the longest vacation in the history of the American presidency. And even when that's finished, he's afraid to go back up to the East Coast. So he goes down to Florida where his brother lives. His
yeah.
brother puts the state on the state of high alert, as if they're expecting some horrible thing to happen. You know, how can somebody look at this and not think that maybe there was at least a conspiracy to allow something to happen that might then allow George Bush to be, you know, a big war hero in the United States, if not outright complicity?
It's pretty clear that if you look at the abundance of data they had, that, and I mean, you can't sustain the idea that this was simply some kind of incompetence, because I mean, what they tell you is that, well, you know, we had institutional problems, there wasn't interagency communication.
But Rice knew this was coming. Bush knew this was coming.
Yeah,
Tenet
I mean,
knew this was
if
coming.
You look at, I mean, this is what I tried to do in my book, The War on Truth. You know, I try to look very closely, not just at the reports, but what happened to these warnings? You know, where did they go? Did they go to the right people? And what you find consistently is that this information was rooted to the highest echelons of the Bush administration, and that they knew. And the question remains, why did they fail to act? It's very difficult to avoid the conclusion that a deliberate decision was made to sit on this information and not to act, and that is a minimal interpretation.
Does that have something to do with why our air defenses failed on 9/11?
Most probably, yeah. I mean, I've looked at the timelines that the commission has put out. These timelines have always been revised by different officials of the government, and now we have a new timeline produced by the 9/11 Commission report. But even looking at what the commission has said, it's so damning. I mean, on the one hand, there are omissions in there. They don't take into account the fact that in the first days after 9/11, we had multiple officials coming out and admitting that they had failed to scramble aircraft entirely all the way until after the Pentagon was hit. General Richard B. Myers testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee on 13th September, and he said that, you know, he confirmed this three times in his testimony, that we didn't actually scramble planes until after the Pentagon was hit. Dick Cheney said the same thing on 15th September in an interview in MSNBC, and other officials have confirmed the same. There's a report in the Boston Globe quoting an official from NIAID confirming the same thing. Now, subsequently, two weeks later, we had this timeline put out by the Air Force.
Now, Fees, we only have a minute left.
Yeah.
I know that you have to go give a speech at the National Press Club in 6 minutes.
Yeah.
Do you think that the Bush administration had anything to do with the actual planning and execution of 9/11? Or are you simply suggesting that they knew it was coming and decided intentionally not to do anything about it because it might work to their political advantage?
Yeah, I mean, you're asking me an awkward question. I normally don't like answering this kind of question because, I mean, what I tend to, I don't like theorizing, I don't like speculating, and what I've done in my book is just give the facts. But if you're asking me my personal opinion, I find it very difficult to avoid the conclusion that the government had some kind of more direct involvement in this. I won't say that is something that I would go around advertising everywhere. I wouldn't say that's the crux of the book. The book is about getting out the fact that these people failed.
This is the biggest intelligence failure in the history of the United States.
And
everybody involved has been promoted.
Exactly. I think the conclusion is in the book that, I mean, it's very difficult to avoid the conclusion that there was some kind of direct involvement, either through complete and utter let's just put on the brakes and watch this happen, or something much more sinister.
Right. Nafees Ahmed, the book is The War on Truth. Is there a website for this, Nafees?
You can go to www.interlinkbooks.com and you should be able to order the book there.
Okay, great. Nafees Ahmed, the book, The War on Truth, 9/11 Disinformation and the Anatomy of Terrorism. Thanks for being with us so much. I do appreciate it. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Hello, Mama. It's me, Osama. I guess you're worrying, wondering where I've been staying.
I don't know, wherever George Bush put you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Mark in Myrtle Beach, California. Is it Florida, Myrtle Beach, Mark?
South Carolina.
South Carolina. Oh, you're right. That's right. I'm sorry. It's been too long since I've been down in the southeast. What's up, Mark?
Well, you know, I keep hearing about your congressman was talking about that was on there earlier.
Yes, Bernie Sanders.
And he's talking about how the Southern Democrat they're the ones that vote on the Republican side here on these bills that come up in front of Congress here.
Yeah, my recollection is he said that of the Democrats who vote on the Republican side, more often than not, they're from the South. Yeah.
Well, that's because people have to understand the Southern Democrat, okay?
Okay.
I'm a Democrat, and I'm from the South, but I'm not a Southern Democrat. I'm a progressive Democrat, and there are very few of us here,
mm-hmm.
Okay? When Abe Lincoln was a Republican and he set the slaves free, the only reason today people vote Democrat in the South, or it is because Abe Lincoln was a Republican.
Because they're still upset with Abe Lincoln.
They're still upset with Abe Lincoln.
Yeah, and that was Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. Was Nixon said, okay, let's go after the racist Democrats and bring them into the Republican Party. And at the same time that that was happening, LBJ was trying to desegregate the South, and Bill Moyers, I believe it was, came to him and said, sir, if we do this, we will lose the Democratic Party in the South for a generation. And LBJ said, that if that's the price to pay for what doing what's right, that's a price I'm willing to pay. And here we are.
The Southern Democratic Party is almost like a third party.
Yeah.
And they always vote conservative.
Yeah. Okay, got it, Mark. Mark, thanks for illuminating us on that. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Victoria on the line. Hey, Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, it's fairly quiet. President Bush is out of town, but Congress is in town trying to finish things up before they go on their month-long recess.
Okay, Victoria, I'm sorry. That line is so bad, I can't hold it on the air. So
okay.
if you can call back on another phone, that'd be great. Otherwise,
I'm going to do that right now.
Okay, or otherwise we can try and pick you up tomorrow or later in the day. But it's just breaking up too bad. And by the way, welcome back to our program. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, high technology for low prices, toll free. You can call Small Dog Electronics for all things computer. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS. We'll get you through. In Iraq, the majority of soldiers are reporting low morale. We've got Victoria back on a decent telephone line. Hey, Victoria. Okay, what's up?
Well, we've got the Senate Foreign Relations having confirmation hearings today for a number of different positions, including Karen Hughes up for her position, basically as, I don't remember the exact title, but it's Winning Hearts and Minds in the Middle East.
Spinmeister.
Oh, maybe that was the title.
Yes,
yeah.
Reich's Spinmeister.
I have to tell you that the bits that I heard today, and I didn't hear much because I was at a Democratic hearing about the leak, she was not getting opposition. There was general support for her from Republicans and Democrats. Senator Joe Biden was in support of her. And if he is, as the ranking Democrat, generally speaking, it's something like that is going to go through easily.
Yeah. Okay. Any word from anybody on whether George Bush handled the memo that the Wall Street Journal today released was actually labeled top secret, do not share with foreign intelligence?
No word on George Bush. More does seem to be coming out about Scooter Libby's involvement, Cheney's chief of staff, who had been saying all along that he wasn't involved at all. It seems that he certainly was involved. It's also seeming more clear that Ari Fleischer, the former press secretary, did see this memo on board Air Force One, at least according to a former senior administration official who says he saw him reading it.
Right, but a top secret memo is not going to go from the State Department to Air Force One out of the printer on Air Force One to Ari Fleischer. It's going to go to the president, or it's going to go to Colin Powell. And I don't think that Colin Powell is going to be interested in circulating to the press secretary a memo that could be damaging to a CIA agent. So who else is left?
Well, the field gets really quite narrow, doesn't it?
Yeah, it gets right down to George W. Bush. And that's why I think he pulled John Roberts out of the hat Tuesday morning. But, you know, we'll see. Maybe I'm a lone nut in the wilderness here. Or maybe I'm Woodward and Bernstein and we've got the next Watergate. I call it Treasongate. In fact, I've got a piece on it on Common Dreams today, Victoria. Check it out.
I'm going right there now.
Okay, commondreams.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. I'm Tom Hartman. It's 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. The place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Welcome back to our program. It's time for our best of the rest of the news segment, our weekly segment when we bring in some of the internet's finest minds and find out what they're thinking, what's going on in the world out there beyond the realm of in the realm of cyberspace and in the realm of the real world. Today we have with us Brad Friedman of bradblog.com and David Swanson of afterdowningstreet.org. Hey, Brad.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great to have you here. Hey, David, how are you doing today?
Hi, Tom, and hi, Brad.
Hey, David, how you doing?
So let's move along on this. Brad blog, first of all, federal court upholds Volusia County decision not to use Diebold touchscreen voting machines. Could this have something to do with Bev Harris going down to Volusia County and going through their garbage?
Well, I'm not sure if what she exactly had to do with this particular court order, but I know that they down there, there are a couple of disabled rights groups sort of wrestling for paper trails on electronic machines. And one of those groups, the National Federation for the Blind, they're the ones who sued Volusia to sort of force them to install these Diebold machines. It turns out that this group, National Federation for the Blind, has actually taken at least $1 million from Diebold through a contribution in the past.
Surprise,
and,
surprise!
I'm sure it has nothing to do with it, to do with their interest in getting these machines in there. They claim that they that their civil rights are being trampled if they're not allowed to use paperless voting machines. Go figure.
Yeah. So so what's going to happen with this? How's this playing out?
Well, there's another group that is also fighting, a group that represents blind folks and disabled folks of all sorts, and they're saying, well, no, just because we're blind doesn't mean we don't want a vote that is verifiable and
right, just because we're blind doesn't mean we're dumb.
Right. So they would like to hold out. There's another system coming through called the AutoMark system, which should be certified in Florida in time. It's been federally certified, but they're hoping that it's certified in the state of Florida in time for the upcoming fall elections. They've got municipal elections down there in September or October. But it's a real knockdown, drag-out fight between these disabled rights groups. And on the other side, they're saying that our civil rights are trampled because we're not being allowed to vote in private, because if there's a paper ballot with every vote cast, then they need to have a third party in the polling booth with them to verify, in fact, that the ballot is correct. It's a mess.
Well, you know, here's a couple of interesting things, Brad. First of all, the Constitution doesn't say that you have the right to a secret ballot.
The Constitution doesn't even say you have the right to vote.
For president, you're right. But the fact of the matter is that from the founding of this country up through the middle to late part of the 1800s, the way the voting was done was community meetings where people raised their hands. We did not use, when we started using paper ballots, it was called the Australian ballot, and it was something we borrowed from Australia in either the late 1860s or the 1870s, I forget which.
Right.
And that was considered a major revolution, the secret ballot, but it has never been established as a constitutional right to a secret ballot, first of all. And secondly, what's the insanity of anybody trying to say it's a good thing that a private for-profit corporation be inserted between us and our vote, and you know the outcome of our vote, that a private for-profit corporation should be handling our vote and doing it in secret, using trade secrecy laws to say that we have no right to see how they handle our vote or what they're doing with our vote before they tell us how we voted? How is it that the disabled rights groups don't get that?
Well, you know what?
Or that Americans don't get that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's not just the disabled rights groups that don't get it. Americans don't get it, and in general, all of Congress doesn't get it. I mean, because there is literally millions and millions of dollars pouring out right now from the Help America Vote Act that goes to these private companies to run, and there's about seven or eight different American voting machine companies that is millions of dollars is going to them to take over these elections entirely. And as you say, these secret machines they're using, Americans have no right to, apparently, to make sure that their votes are counted accurately, and they have no way of going back and making sure that they are, because these, again, these voting machine companies like Diebold and ES&S that tally over 80% of Americans' votes and growing, you know, have ensured that this will never happen. They've given so much money to the folks in Congress that they're pretty much bought and sold at this point, and they agree that, well, you know, these are trade secrets. Yes, you can see how ATMs work through open source software, but not voting machines. I mean, it's an outrage, and as I think you know, it's something that I've been reporting on at least since November 2nd of this year, as I know you have as well, to try to raise attention and say, hey, guys, pay attention, because we have no way of making sure these votes are accurate. And once again, in 2004, We had an election that nobody can be certain of, and you would think that even the folks that win, in this case the Bushies, you would think that they would want everyone to believe they are a legitimate...
unless they stole the election. Did you just say that ATMs are using open-source software?
In fact, Diebold sells a machine, an ATM open-source software machine, that everyone can see the code and everyone can see how it happens, and yet that same Diebold argues that due to competition reasons, they can't release the software to their...
Amazing. Yep. Amazing. Brad Freeman with bradblog.com. David Swanson is with us also, after downingstreet.org. David, you've got some... today is a big day, this weekend a big weekend. You've got events coming up. Tell us about it.
Something big happened yesterday, and some big things are happening tomorrow. Yesterday, Congresswoman Barbara Lee introduced in the House of Representatives a resolution of inquiry that we are going to be building support for. And if it were to manage to pass over the Republican majority, would require the White House and the State Department to turn over to the Congress all communications between them and officials of the United Kingdom from January to October 2002. So this is asking for information from this side of the ocean contemporaneous to and relevant to the Downing Street memo.
So this is about the collusion between the Bushies and the Blairies about lying us into a war.
Right, because all we've got in terms of authoritative documents is coming out of England. And if the Bush administration has documents that can disprove all of this body of evidence and suggest that we're all off on the wrong tack and have got everything wrong and they really meant well, they were just incredibly incompetent, then they ought to want to put the information out there and clear this all up. And so Barbara Lee is offering them that opportunity, and we'll see if they go for it.
What do you think is going to happen?
I think we're going to build a large number of supporters of the resolution in the House, most if not all of the Democrats, and there's reason to hope some Republicans. There are Republicans questioning the war. There's no reason for them not to question the lies that launched the war. And in any case, we will be having over 300, close to 400 events around the country tomorrow promoting this resolution and promoting the issue of not just the Rove Libby affair, but the bigger campaign that sold us a war on fraudulent bases. And so there will be town hall forums with Congress members and expert witnesses, dramatic recreations of the Downing Street meeting, protests, rallies, house parties, all sorts of activities tomorrow, because it's 3 years tomorrow since the now infamous meeting at number 10 Downing Street.
This is the anniversary tomorrow.
Right, right.
So folks all over the country are getting together and having meetings, right?
That's right, and anybody can go to afterdowningstreet.org and click on the events page and either sign up to attend a meeting in your neighborhood or, although it's last minute at this point, create one and have
a house party.
Sign up.
These are basically house parties.
Now, many of these are house parties showing DVDs. Others are study circles. Many are big public forums and town hall meetings. And some are marches and rallies and protests at media outlets. There's pretty much everything you can imagine.
Yeah, a wide variety of stuff, all centered around this whole issue of After Downing Street, the After Downing Street memos, the memos that indicate that Bush was intentionally lying to us, and that those lies have now led to the death of over 1,700 Americans, as many as 100,000 Iraqis, perhaps more, and the destruction of America's reputation around the world.
That's exactly right, of America's reputation and England's along with us. And these documents, we could not imagine better evidence we could get our hands on than these documents. And they're now public, and they make a compelling case that the president took us to war on a fraudulent basis. There could not be a higher crime. If this is not an instance in which we start considering impeachment, then there never can be one.
Well, speaking of impeachment and what might be done around it, I wrote an op-ed piece today for Common Dreams they put up this morning, in which I suggested that it looks like the trail of evidence on the current memo, the information, and this is sort of the back end of this. This is what the administration did to cover up what the Downing Street memo was outing, but this, of course, was before the Downing Street memo came out. Joe Wilson comes out and says, Bush has lied to you. There was no uranium. This was after the invasion. And, you know, stop, you know, wake up. And so in the White House, apparently somebody says, you know, find out who this guy is, what's going on, what's the deal. Colin Powell orders an investigation. The investigation is done at the State Department. They produce this memo, which is labeled top secret. The paragraph in it that outs that names Valerie Plame is marked, do not even share with foreign intelligence services. This is so secret. And Colin Powell, George Bush are on Air Force One, and this memo gets sent to Air Force One, or it's brought on Air Force One by Colin Powell. Nobody's really sure which it was. It appears that perhaps it was just sent to Air Force One, you know, printed out on their secure fax machine or whatever. And then within hours of that, you have Karl Rove and Scooter Libby dialing for dollars, calling members of the press and saying, hey, did you know that this guy's wife works for the CIA? Karl Rove calling Chris Matthews while he's on the air saying, Joe Wilson's wife is fair game, that kind of stuff. I mean, within hours of this. And who could have handled that thing on Air Force One who would have instant connections to George W. Bush's assistant and Dick Cheney's assistant? I don't think it would be Colin Powell. This is above his pay grade. I don't think it would be Ari Fleischer. He wouldn't take on something like that all by himself. It would have to be George W. Bush, would it not? Or am I missing something here? David, what's your take on this?
I don't think we can be sure, but I think you make a very strong case, and it fits with the story that came out last night from Bloomberg that says, you know, Rove under oath fingered Novak as his source, but Novak said otherwise, and Libby pointed to Tim Russert as his source, but Tim Russert said otherwise. So these guys are tying themselves in knots, and it's entirely possible that the reason is the one you suggest.
They're protecting the president.
Exactly. Exactly.
And they figure that maybe they can get away with it. Maybe they can lie and protect the president, because when Patrick Fitzgerald finds out that it's the president, he'll just say, oh, oops, I'm a good Republican. We're not going to go any farther than that. Maybe that's their hope. I frankly don't think that'll happen. But
yeah, you know, let me jump in here for a second on that.
Yes, Brad.
I think that there's a lot of areas here that we're going to begin to see that ask that question, what did the president know and when did he know it? Because whether he got involved initially on Air Force One, as you suggest he may have, or if his involvement came later when you recall that he came out and he said, well, you know, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. If anyone leaked information from my administration, they're going to be fired. And he claims to have, you know, spoken to all these key players, Karl Rove and so forth. Scott McClellan came out and said he personally spoke to Rove and said it was ridiculous. Well, the question is, then once the leak was confirmed to have come from Rove,
Hang on. Just let me interrupt you here on the timeline there, Brad. Bush does his little investigation, and then he meets with the press, and this is actually what he said. Hang on just a second.
I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So George Bush himself saying, we're not going to find out who it is. Could that be because it's George Bush?
Well, the question is, if he spoke to Rove about this, and if Rove gave him any indication one way or another that he spoke to Novak, that he was the source for Novak or any of the others, and then Bush did nothing about it, in other words, he didn't follow through with his promise to take care of him, we assume that means fired. In this administration, it could mean given a Medal of Honor. Or
well, not just his promise. I mean, he's got a constitutional duty to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States. A law was broken here.
Well, we don't know. Was the law broken? We don't know the details yet. It seems as if it was. It seems as if there was a number of laws that were potentially broken. They do have a non-disclosure agreement that administration officials cannot give away classified information. They cannot even confirm or deny any information that may be classified. So, yeah, it's very possible that a law was broken here, but as we found in the past, it tends to be the cover-up than the crime. And if Bush had any idea, in fact, that Rove had spoken to any of these folks, was the source for this leak, and then did nothing about it, that means he knew about it in advance, and that makes him an accessory to whatever did happen.
Right, so, a conspirator, a co-conspirator.
Exactly. So I think that there's a lot of interesting questions.
Which is what Nixon was going to get impeached for. We got 30 seconds left. David Swanson, your take on this, or any final comments you want to make?
Well, whether or not these speculations about Bush have anything to them, he at this point is saying that he wants to know who did it, but he's failing to ask Karl Rove or Libby to step forward and say. He's saying, let's wait for the investigation. We want to know the facts. Well, if he wanted to know the facts, he could insist on having them and making them public.
He could have simply asked.
So
yeah.
He's conspiring now, regardless of what he may have done and whether he was the root of this to begin with.
Yeah, well said. Okay, David Swanson with AfterDowningStreet.org. Check out AfterDowningStreet.org to find out where you can attend meetings near you, what you can do about the After Downing Street memo. We've got to keep this thing alive. This is a big deal. And Brad with BradBlog.com. And for more information on what's going on with Diebold and many other things, Brad blogs on a whole bunch of topics. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Have a good one and a great weekend. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It seemed that life was so wonderful and comfortable, 'cause we were powerful and in control. Then Daddy's judges came through and they appointed me the president, with no precedent, Pennsylvania Avenue resident.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, 4.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. One of the folks in our chat room points out, which you can get to, by the way, by going to TomHartman.com and clicking live chat. One of the folks in our chat room points out that on the White House website, you go to whitehouse.gov/, and this is all lowercase, /infocus/national security/disarm.html. whitehouse.gov/infocus/national security/disarm.html. The gravest danger we face of the war on terror is outlaw regimes that seek and possess nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. 12 years ago, Saddam Hussein agreed to disarm all weapons of mass destruction. For 12 years, he systematically violated that agreement. Folks at the White House, participated with the weapons inspector, Scott Ritter. It wasn't a very friendly participation, but he let them in, and they blew up everything. I'm sorry. Everything got this. Okay. 3 months ago, the United States Nations Security Council, this is dated April 18th, 2003. 3 months ago, as they were ginning up to war, the UN Security Council gave Saddam his final choice to disarm. He has shown utter contempt for the UN. No, he let in the inspectors. The UN and U.S. intelligence sources. Have known for some time that Saddam Hussein has 26,000 liters of anthrax, enough to kill several million people, 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin, 500 tons of sarin, mustard, and VX nerve agents, almost 30,000 munitions capable of delivering chemical agents. Yeah. From three Iraqi defectors.
Ahmed Chalabi and his brother and brother-in-law.
From three Iraqi defectors, we know that Iraq in the late 1990s had several mobile biological weapons labs, but he has not disclosed them. Yes, that's because they don't exist. The IAEA confirmed that in the 1990s, Saddam Hussein had a nuclear weapons development program. Yes, in 1990, when Don Rumsfeld was over there shaking his hand, we were helping him do that. That all went to an end in 1991. Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my. Ah, what, you know, something about tangled webs and practicing to deceive. And now we find George W. Bush trying to hide this stuff, trying to cover it up by trashing Joe Wilson and all these cons going along with him on it. It's absolutely extraordinary the lengths to which they will go in character assassination and obfuscation to change the topic away from their own lies.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, where tuning in is as easy as getting a White House press pass if you're a gay hooker. Yes, indeed, my friends. 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Let's look at the Republican signature achievements, the stuff that the Republicans, the White House, says, you know, to their merry troops, their band of loyal supporters. This is what we've brought you. Huge tax breaks for the top 1% earners in the United States. Massive. Destruction of the middle class, an increase in the number of poor people in the United States. An illegal war in Iraq, $300 billion spent so far. Record trade deficits, $666 billion last year. Doesn't even that number give you the chills? Record budget deficits. Record national debt, we're up to $7 trillion. Before Ronald Reagan came into office, we'd never even had $1 trillion. Aren't Republicans great at running the country into the ditch? Or as Grover Norquist would say, shrinking government down to the point where you can drag it into the bathroom and drown it in the bathtub. Yes. They dismantled the EPA. They put the number four top polluter in charge of the EPA. An official, a former CEO of the company that was the fourth worst polluter in America, is now in charge of the EPA. They dismantled the Securities and Exchange Commission, put corporate cronies in charge of that. They prevented us from filing class action lawsuits against corporations who harm us. Remember that? The tort reform. They made it harder for working people to file bankruptcy. Although they made sure that there was an exception in there so that if you're a multimillionaire and you create an asset protection trust, you can declare bankruptcy, skate free, and keep all your money. Oh, yeah, but, you know, it costs about $250,000 to put one of those things together. So they're really only useful for people who have assets of over a million or two or three or five or ten or 50 or, you know, like that. Don Trump, he's in bankruptcy right now. His property in Nevada, in Las Vegas, doesn't seem to harm his TV show, but, you know, rich people use bankruptcy in a very different way than the average person. He is trying to dismantle Social Security. May actually have a good shot at it this year. We'll see. They may get the first whack in anyway. Speaking of wackos, packed the federal court with them. More than half of all the federal bench, all the federal judges right now have been appointed by George W. Bush, because for the last 4 years of the Clinton administration, Republicans were obstructing the nomination of federal judges and refusing to allow them out of committee, refusing to allow votes in the Senate. He has put Death Squad John Negroponte in charge of all of our intelligence, the guy who is running death squads down in South America. They sent him over to Iraq for a short while, just for a few months, and all of a sudden, dead bodies started showing up, 5, 10, 15 at a time, people with, you know, all shot in the head, just like they were in Nicaragua when Negroponte went down there. Now he's in charge of all intelligence here. Gonzalez is attorney general. Redefined torture. That was one of their signature achievements. He took the person who was in charge of national security, who allowed 9/11 to happen, even though she had received numerous warnings, and promoted her to attorney general. Excuse me, to secretary of state. George W. Bush has presided over the largest corporate welfare handouts in the history of the United States. The amount of corporate welfare that has been given to corporations in the last 3 years of the Bush administration exceeds that of all previous years. Cuts in Social Security programs at the same time for the poor and needy. Cuts in veterans benefits for those fighting his war of choice in Iraq. He's trying to dismantle public education, our schools, our state schools, by pushing through by not funding the No Child Left Behind Act, and pushing it through as well, which says you got to teach to the test, but by the way, we're not going to give you any money, and you got to buy the test from one of our crony corporations, our for-profit corporations. We're privatizing testing in the United States, privatizing part of our educational system, and we're not going to give you any money for that either. And, you know, when the schools start falling apart, tough luck. 9/11 was imminent. Here are George Bush, 56 memos that George Bush got leading up to 9/11 that specifically talked about the dangers of Al-Qaeda. One of them talked about flying airplanes into buildings. One of them talked about hijacking aircraft. On August 6th, he gets one that says, Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. And what does he do? He goes on the longest vacation in the history of the presidency and did not warn you, did not warn me, did not warn the people at the World Trade Center, didn't even bother to warn the airlines who could have hardened their cockpit doors and actually prevented 9/11. He still hasn't found a 7-foot-tall Saudi dragging a dialysis machine around on a camel after 3 years. The Carlyle Group, Papa Bush, and Bucky Bush Armor Plating Company are making millions off the war, while Cheney's Halliburton is making billions off the reconstruction and fuel supply, processing Iraq's oil. They've destroyed our credibility in the eyes of the world. In fact, according to some surveys, George W. Bush may be the most hated person alive on the earth. Tragically. I mean, tragically. I mourn for my country. They have cut funds for Medicaid and Medicare. They have allowed North Korea and Iran to develop nuclear weapons, or at least begin the process. Certainly North Korea has done it. They've allowed communist China to take control of the American economy. Communist China is sitting on so much of our debt right now. They have bought so many of our treasuries that if communist China decided tomorrow morning that they wanted to sell those things, stop buying them and start selling them and flood the market with them, you would have a disaster in the United States that would be worse than the Great Depression. It would look more like Germany in 1928. You would see such a massive hyperinflation. The cost of a loaf of bread would go from $1 to $5 to $10 to $20 to $50 to $100 in the course of a few weeks. They've allowed Saudi Arabia to participate in this. They've privatized our voting process, turned our votes over to private for-profit corporations, causing a lot of people to wonder if the last three elections have been stolen. When George Bush came into office, the price of oil was $18 a barrel. Now it's $60. They've doubled oil prices. They've more than doubled oil prices. At the same time, gasoline prices have gone up. In fact, more than oil prices. Gasoline companies, the oil companies that provide us with gasoline now, are making higher profits than they have ever made before. You'd think if the price of their raw material goes up, their profits would go down, wouldn't you? I mean, that's the rationale they use for Walmart. They say, oh, if Walmart had to pay its worker bees more, then you'd have to pay more at Walmart. Part of the raw material of Walmart is labor, right? If one of our raw material costs goes up, then, the price of the product is going to go up, and the company won't make as much money. But when the cost of the raw material in the oil industry goes up, the oil industry makes a fortune. They just jack up the price of gasoline even more. And nobody's talking about it. When was the last time you saw a story about this in the media? The oil company's ripping us off. The Bush administration has increased terror all over the world. We've seen roughly a doubling of the number of worldwide terrorist attacks every year that George Bush has been president. He lies to us about the number of dead soldiers in Iraq, doesn't count the ones who died after medevac. We're 26,000 jobs in the hole since George Bush first took office. The first president since Herbert Hoover, not to create one single private sector job. He lost almost $9 billion in Iraq. Can't figure out where it went. Not only that, they ran the oil out of Iraq without even hooking a meter up to it. Halliburton pumping that stuff out of there as fast as they can. We have no idea how much we took. We have no idea how much our oil companies got. And Iraq doesn't get any money for it. He's protected polluters from being sued by us to clean up our water supplies. He's refused to promote alternative energy at the same time that we find ourselves with the hands of the oil-producing countries around our necks. He's increased the tax breaks for gas-guzzling SUVs. And to top the whole thing off, he outed a covert CIA agent and shut down an ongoing WMD intelligence operation for revenge. For revenge. Representative John Tierney of Massachusetts had something to say about that, some thoughts on the issue. Let me just share them with
you. Mr. Rove chooses not to come clean. All he really needs to do is hold a press conference and state clearly the facts of the incident involved, and we'd pretty much know what the answers were. But he hasn't done that. He apparently chooses not to do it, nor does the president apparently choose to require him to do it. It's important for us to know whether or not it's just a matter of an ethical lapse or whether it's a security breach. On September 30th of 2003, President Bush said, and I quote, "If somebody did leak classified information, I'd like to know it, and we'll take the appropriate action." Well, now he knows of Mr. Grove's conversations, and we'd like to know what action he's going to take and his zeal to get to the bottom of this. All he needs to do is instruct everybody in his administration to come clean with what it is that they may or may not have done, what they said, to whom they said it, and where, and when it was said.
But, Congressman Tierney, that would require George W. Bush to, A, be honest, B, hold people in his administration accountable, and C, possibly it may even lead to George Bush having to admit that he was the one who ordered Joe Wilson's wife to be outed, because it looks like the memo passed through his hands. Although John Tierney keeps the focus on Karl Rove, perhaps appropriately.
Mr. Rove is apparently a serial leaker, having had a previous incident back with Mr. Bush the first in the second presidential campaign, where Mr. Rove allegedly leaked information to none other than Mr. Novak. So now, until we know whether or not Mr. Rove has leaked sensitive information, our concern ought to be for those intelligence officials who are still out there and operating and who are still at risk. We have to, I think, in the interim, remove Mr. Rove's security clearances to take the sensitive information away from him until the investigation is done.
At the very least. At the very least. And, you know, how about maybe a little protective custody for a while? How about some detention? I mean, why is Judith Miller in jail and Karl Rove is still calling the shots? Does that not sound like the way a mafia family would be run?
It's a responsibility, I think, that the White House should attend to quickly. I think the president, in his previous comments, indicated that he would act. I think that this is something I'm glad that our colleagues have all joined together in sending a letter to the president. We're hoping that he responds immediately to that particular directive.
Yeah, now that was about a month ago, a few weeks ago anyway, three or four weeks ago. Congressman John Tierney and a group of members of the United States Congress sent a letter, nearly 100, sent a letter to George W. Bush saying, please tell us the truth about what's going on. Please come clean. Please ask the people in your administration to tell us what's going on. We'd like to know. I mean, the national security of the United States is being compromised here. How about some real information? Nothing. Not one. Well, yeah, okay. Well, we get George Bush coming in. Yes, I'm glad you asked that question. If anybody in my administration is convicted of a crime, then I'll fire them. Well, they'll be in jail. I mean, they couldn't do their job very well from jail, could they? Convicted of a crime. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We got a president so bad, gotta be the worst we ever had. Got the job because of his dad, now we're all in danger. He come around up to no good, broke the old treaties cause he could. Struck us all around like a hood, got us in a world of trouble.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where smart people get their news. Hang on just a second. Got to close a private chat window here. These things pop up on top of my call screening software. I can't tell what's going on. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. George W. Bush and his administration up to here, shall we say, in...
Well, let me see. That would be 145 million and a half tons of the...
Refuse.
Yeah, refuse, yes. Per every day. And by the year, let me figure, over 53 million tons of...
Manure?
Manure, yeah. By comparison, the pyramid of the Pharaoh-Cheops weighs about 690 million tons, which means that every 4 3/4 days, you've got a pile of this...
Excrement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all you have to do is watch afternoon TV to see it and find out what's the press conferences from the White House. A congressional candidate who wants to impeach President Bush insists he can win the Republican primary. This is interesting. This is the guy who wants to run for the seat in the U.S. House of Representatives that Bernie Sanders is going to be vacating at the end of next year when he goes to the Senate, assuming that he wins the election. Bernie is going to have a tough time. He's going to be running against a guy who could throw as much as $5 million of his own personal money into an election in a state that only has 600,000 people. But nonetheless, Dennis Morisot of West Paulet, Vermont, says he plans to seek the Republican nomination to run for the U.S. House of Representatives, Bernie Sanders' seat. And a central part of his platform, this is the Republican candidate, a central part of his platform, Morisot said, will be bringing articles of impeachment against George W. Bush. Be interesting to see how long this guy lasts in the Republican Party. Somehow I think he doesn't have a bright future. Color me cynical or skeptical, but I just, don't think it's going to happen. Good news from the Army. Troop morale is better than it was. Sort of. Actually, what they're finding is that troop morale remains low among troops in Iraq, especially those in the National Guard and Reserve units, with over half of soldiers rating their unit's morale as low to very low. According to the report, the most troubling factor for the soldiers is the length of required stay in Iraq. At the beginning of the war, most were deployed for 6 months, but now they're required to stay an entire year. 13% tested positive for psychological problems, mental health problems. 13% of soldiers. The report recommended that the Army reconsider whether National Guard and Reserve troops are receiving adequate training and skills. This, rather, I would say, confirms the fact that Bush was clueless when they sent all these soldiers over to Iraq, the consequences of an occupation. I mean, they had the invasion part down. You got to give Rumsfeld credit. He knows how to invade a country. He had plenty of opportunity to watch. He was part of the Reagan administration. The Ford administration anyway. He'd seen Reagan invade Grenada. He'd seen, Bush invade Panama. He'd seen a whole bunch of invasions. He knew that we know how to do invasions. But occupations? That's a whole other thing. Got an email from somebody the other day saying, how can you say that this is a phony war in Iraq? It's not a phony war. They're shooting at us. Yes, the word war, however, is phony. Arguably, you could say that the invasion was a war, although arguably there was no formal declaration of war and it violated the UN Charter and UN Resolution 1440. But nonetheless, you could say, okay, the invasion was a war. Bush declared victory on May 1st on that. He said, hey, the battle for Baghdad is over. We have prevailed. And he was right. We won the war. Now we have an occupation. We are losing the occupation. When we won the war, only 200 Americans were dead. Now it's 1,700. You do the math. 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
The Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back.
Somebody sing,
hello, hello, hello.
Somebody sing. Somebody cry, why?
Yeah. Welcome back. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Nobody's singing or there's a lot of folks crying. This is the tragedy of this occupation in Iraq, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, the absolute disaster, the tragedy of it, the human tragedy of it. I think most Americans are only beginning to sense in the smallest ways. And that's folks who know somebody who died there or who know the family of somebody who died there or who have seen on television the family of somebody who died in Iraq. But consider the families in Iraq who have seen their loved ones die. I'm sorry. At times, it is entirely appropriate for the United States to say that it is our policy to help participate in changing the government of another nation. I believe that. I'm an interventionist. Okay? Put me down. However, I believe it's few and far between, and only in the case of regimes where the people who are leading them are threatening the rest of the world, threatening their neighbors in very serious ways, like Adolf Hitler did, or committing genocide against their own people, as Adolf Hitler did. I think that you could build a strong case that we should be intervening in the Sudan. Look at what's going on in the Darfur region, or in Zimbabwe, where 2 million people are facing starvation right at this moment as we speak, because of the draconian, radical policies of Mr. Mugabe. But Iraq? We had Saddam in a box. There are so many other ways to help overthrow a government. I mean, you know, it's not like the United States doesn't know how to do this. So George, you know, he wanted to have a war. He just really had to have a war, because that's how you get political capital.
As a condition for ending the Persian Gulf War, the Iraqi regime was required to destroy its weapons of mass destruction.
And, of course, they did.
To cease all development of such weapons.
And they did. And Scott Ritter and the United Nations confirmed that.
And to stop all support for terrorist groups.
And other than sending $25,000 to the families of suicide bombers in Israel, they did. And that was something that not only was Saddam doing, but Saudi Arabia, the country that bankrolled your purchase of the Texas, your share of the Texas Rangers, was doing.
The Iraqi regime has violated all of those obligations.
Mm-hmm.
It possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. It is seeking nuclear weapons.
Well, George, come on. Iraq has presented no threat to us. They certainly had nothing to do with 9/11, did they? I mean, it's not...
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001.
Oh, here we go.
America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
This is why the majority of people who voted Republican, over 70% of people who watch Fox News, about 65% of people who voted for George W. Bush, believe that Iraq was somehow involved in 9/11. Because every time George W. Bush gave a speech about Iraq or Saddam Hussein, he dragged out this little piece of 9/11 memorabilia and waved it around, and it imprinted our brains. Even though he didn't say Saddam was behind 9/11, even though he had even gone so far as to say Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11. Remember that?
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
No. We've had no evidence. Let me play that one more time.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th. No.
Now that, of course, a moment of candor in a news conference, quite different from speeches that he gives when he tries to conflate the two, to tie the two together. But let us never forget the war lies that this weekend, tomorrow, the Downing Street memo, tomorrow is the third anniversary of the Downing Street memo having been written. 3 years ago, this week, the head of MI5, Richard Dearlove, was in the United States meeting with our intelligence officials. He went back to the UK, and he wrote this memo 3 years ago tomorrow that said the United States government is going to war against Saddam, whether we like it or not. They are fixing the intelligence to match the policy of invasion. There's nothing we can do about it. We might as well go along with it. And Tony Blair saying, let's go along with it. George W. Bush lying us in.
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
Yeah, and those serious dangers, George, are?
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do.
We do? We do?
Does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
Yeah, he grows even stronger. This is a guy, we had bombed his Air Force into smithereens. His army was a bunch of 15-year-old conscripts wearing tattered uniforms. He had no Air Force whatsoever. He had very, I mean, just, there was nothing there. I mean, we knocked this guy over in a couple of weeks with 100,000 soldiers. It was no big deal. It was like Reagan invading Grenada when the news was coming out about Iran-Contra and he needed a distraction. It's the, you know, it's the Republican way.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons.
Ah, here it comes. Yes, indeed. You need to worry. You need to be afraid. Saddam, he's going to come and get us.
And is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Yeah, that was actually stuff that Don Rumsfeld helped them make. He went over there and shook Saddam's hand, and that was during the administration of your father, excuse me, and when Saddam was our guy. Remember? I mean, you know, we helped overthrow the democratically elected guy that he replaced. He was our guy. And so, yeah, maybe he had some of those weapons, but after 91, we know he didn't. We took them all out. And the world knew it. Saddam was saying it. Again, not to defend Saddam Hussein. Never to defend Saddam Hussein. But this, is it worth the death, the blood of 1,700, going on 1,800 American soldiers, and certainly more to come, because this occupation is not going well. And the dismemberment, the maiming, the physical maiming of tens of thousands of American soldiers, the psychological wounding of perhaps over 100,000 American soldiers, and the death of over 100,000 Iraqi civilians, not to mention the psychological wounding of millions of Iraqi civilians. Not to mention the investment of $300 billion of our hard-earned cash. Is it worth it? So that Halliburton can pump oil unmetered? Somehow I think not. But anyhow, George W. Bush, as he was lying us into this war, the anniversary this weekend, go to afterdowningstreet.org and you can check out where you can go to a house party this weekend or a meeting or a rally and see DVDs, hear information, learn more about what happened, how it happened, the Downing Street memo, and the Downing Street memo tying into the Plamegate memo, or Treasongate, as I prefer to call it. All of this stuff, you connect the dots, you put it all together, it's all of one piece of fabric. And that is traitors within the United States selling out our intelligence service because our intelligence service dared to say, no, we don't think that there's weapons there. Oh, no, we've got Ahmed Chalabi. He says there are. We've got Curveball. Well, yeah, he's an alcoholic and a drug addict, and Chalabi is a convicted bank swindler, sentenced to 27 years of hard labor in Jordan, but he's our guy. He's a neocon from way back. He'll go along with us. Was it that the Bushies were believing the lies of the Iraqis, of the Chalabis, or was it that the Chalabis were telling lies that they knew the Bushies would buy because they were going to lie us into it anyway? I tend to believe the latter, particularly when you consider things like the fact that Saddam Hussein's son, Uday, had a couple of model airplanes, one in particular with about a 10 or 12 foot wingspan made out of balsa wood. You know, these little remote control airplanes? You sit there, you'd operate it with a little joystick. And somebody saw it, apparently. Maybe it was a satellite photo. Who knows? But George Bush decided that's got to be a big deal. That's got to be a really dangerous thing. We can really scare people with this.
Through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles that could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas. We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
Yeah, they're coming to get us. Uday and his model airplanes, they're coming to get us. Look out, folks. It's a house of cards. It's a house of cards. It's a set of lies. It's a pack of lies. I mean, just very simply put, a pack of lies. And in order to keep us believing it, they could not have credible people like Joe Wilson, who was our last ambassador in Iraq, our last diplomatic, senior diplomatic official in Iraq before the Gulf War. They couldn't have somebody like Joe Wilson coming out and saying, hey, guess what, folks? It's a pack of lies. Couldn't have it. And while it was too late to undo the damage that Joe Wilson had done with his op-ed piece in the New York Times, it wasn't too late to say to anybody else out there who was thinking about saying, hey, you know, Joe Wilson, what he said, he's right. I work in the CIA, and I'll tell you that what he said is true. And I work in the NSA, and I'll tell you what he said is true. And I work in the State Department, and I'll tell you what he's... Any of those folks, terrify them. That had to be Bush's order. Bush's order to Rove and to Libby, terrify them. Take out their families. This is what the mafia does. They don't just go after you. They go after your family. Take out their families. So he had to stop it. He had to stop it. He had no choice but to stop it. And then he continues.
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or steal an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
And it just, you know, again, there it's look out, look out. Nuclear, nuclear, nuclear. See, now that's the big part of the lie. That was the most scary part of the lie. And that was the part that Joe Wilson went after. And that's why he represented the biggest threat. And then George brought his speech back to 9/11 again, of course, as he always does.
We've experienced the horror of September the 11th. We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people.
Could it be that rather than hating America, they hate American foreign policy? Just a question.
Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
A nuclear weapon. And thus, George wraps up his speech. Now, keep in mind, this is all pre-Joe Wilson. As he was lying us into his war, into this war, he wraps up his speech.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun, that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Dave in Humboldt County. Dave, how you doing today?
Oh, very, very good. And yourself?
I'm fine.
As deceitful, as fraudulent, as rotten as this administration is, what you're pointing out today adds up. Put it together with the first days of PNAC, planning for the New World Order. In order to get the country behind us, we will need to have a new Pearl Harbor. And, you know, to me, that's they're right on track. They brought their Pearl Harbor down on us. That's some real serious criminals.
So you're suggesting that you think that George Bush actually was behind 9/11?
Well, I don't think he was the brains of it. I think that went more into the Rove and Wolfowitz, but I think, yes, indeed, of course.
You know what is so saddening, Dave, is that so many people in America are starting to think this. I mean, just that we would live in a country where our administration would be so corrupt that people would think that they were a participant in this. It's tragic.
Bin Laden had no means to keep our Air Force tied up on the ground for an hour and a half while all this craziness went on. Bin Laden did not have the means to plant explosives in those buildings. Bin Laden could not have authorized flying 160 Al-Qaeda Arabs around while the rest of the world, all the other planes were grounded.
Well, they weren't Al-Qaeda Arabs. They were the Bin Laden family.
Bin Laden
family. Let's, you know, keep it straight here.
All right. Yes, it was. It wasn't all Bin Laden family, but much of it was. But I am saying thank you for a job well done, and everybody involved in it, stupid as they were, got promoted.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it is truly, truly amazing. I mean, it's just, and And George Bush, you know.
We've got no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Every now and then you get a little bit of truth. we've got no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. No, but then more often than not, you don't get the truth. And so
These dots all connect in a way that nobody wants them to connect, but we have a horrible group of folks in our White House.
Yeah, and Bush trying to say to us, this is the will of the people. Well, maybe not. Maybe it's my will.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Yeah, how dare you think that this is a democracy?
We owe it all to voting machines.
Yeah, it may well be. Dave, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. Yeah, I mean, you start stacking up the conspiracies, right? It's the voting machines. Oh, it's, you know, and the horrible thing is that maybe it is. Yeah, you heard it here first. He's gone over the top. He's gone over the edge. Hartman's gone. No, I think I'm still rational. It's 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Four and a half minutes here before the hour, before the top of the hour. The Bush administration has asked, now here, you know, we've documented, I think, fairly well the fact that we were lied into this thing, and what a horrific and terrible and tragic mess it is at that. And then on top of that now, in order to get more bodies for their war, I mean, it's like, you know, in order to get more bodies for their war, the Bush administration is asking Congress, the Defense Department has asked Congress, this was Monday of this week, and it completely slipped under the radar of the mainstream media, to raise the age at which you can enlist in the Army. Now, currently, if you're over 35 years old and you show up at a recruiting station, they're going to say, sorry, we're looking for people 35 and younger to become soldiers. And we're talking about people who are going to go through basic training and go off to Iraq, right? You got to be 35 or younger. And the Pentagon has asked to increase that from 35 to 45. Excuse me, 42. To 42 years old. From 35 to 42. As the terrors of the economic situation in the United States spread, they're looking to get more and more people, you know, more and more poor people, basically, into the Army. I mean, this is the tragedy that Thomas Jefferson warned us about when he said, I hope I shall never see the day in my country when a young man will be willing to be shot at for a sixpence. He said, I hope we shall never have pauper hirelings in our Army. Well, a study was just done on who is dying in Iraq. And what they found was that among those who died in Iraq from large suburban areas, the vast majority of them were black or Hispanics. And among those who were white who died in Iraq, the vast majority of them were from very small rural areas, poor areas, areas devastated by poverty. And now is this that, you know, only poor people are getting stuck out there to get shot at? No, it's because what you're seeing is a representative cross-section, a sampling, of the Army, of the people who are getting shot at in general. That this is very much become a poor person's war. Here's the scam. Destroy the economy, then you got a bunch of people who are desperate for anything to get in, you know, any kind of income. You got to send, you know, got to pay for their kids and take care of their wife or husband and take care of their parents in their old age, whatever. And then you say, okay, now we got $15,000 signing bonuses, $20,000, $30,000, $150,000 if you're going to special forces, signing bonuses. And there you go. You get yourself an Army. Raise the age up to 42. We've got to get active, my friends. We've got to get active in politics and change this administration in the 06 elections. You can do it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And have a great weekend.